The quality of general officers, as I've already suggested, was about the same, north and south. We can give a few numbers here as well. There are eventually 583 men who became United States generals, Union generals during the war. 425 became Confederate generals. Of those Union generals, 264, or 47%, were either West Pointers or had significant military experience before the war. 47%. On the Confederate side, 194, or 45%, were either West Pointers or had significant military experience before the war. So it's almost exactly the same proportion. Again, both sides are drawing on pools of potential commanders that look very much like each other. Although there were instances where men with no military training achieved high command, and in some cases did very well, Wade Hampton of South Carolina, Nathan Bedford Forrest of Tennessee, John Brown Gordon of Georgia are the three most conspicuous Confederate examples, I think, of men with no military training who achieved high command. Daniel Sickles, a politician from New York, is a man who achieved corps command in the Union Army without benefit of significant military background. But those men are clear exceptions to the rule that high commands, posts of great responsibility, went to West Pointers and other regularly trained men on both sides. And in terms of Army commanders, it is a West Point club. Because it was a West Point club, it's very important to remember that these men shared essentially the same experience as cadets at West Point. They took the same courses from the same professors. They read the same books. They absorbed the same body of doctrine, to use a modern term that they wouldn't have used, during the course of their studies there. And beyond that, they shared, in a wider sense, a common military heritage. Many of them had served together in Mexico, where again they had learned the same lessons, whether as a soldier in Winfield Scott's army that made the famous campaign from Veracruz to Mexico City, or whether they served in Northern Mexico with Zachary Taylor. They watched Scott and they watched Taylor, and many of them tried to emulate one or another, or in some instances both of those officers during their Civil War careers. For example, Ulysses S. Grant, I think, was much influenced both by service under Zachary Taylor and Zachary Taylor's example, and by Winfield Scott on the campaign from Veracruz to Mexico City. These are men whose training and experience all came from one common group of sources, and because of that, they tended to subscribe to the same ideas about strategy and tactics. Now, for our purposes, we can define tactics as that branch of warfare involving the actual combat between attackers and defenders. Strategy, for us, is the branch of warfare involving the movement of armies to a particular point to bring about combat with an enemy under favorable circumstances, or to force the retreat of the enemy. It's possible to divide this into more levels than that. You can call what I've just described as strategy, operational strategy, and then move to a higher level called national strategy or grand strategy, which would involve the overall war aims of each side. But for our discussion today, let's use the simpler definition of tactics and of strategy. And most of these men who held high positions of command on both sides subscribed to basically the same ideas about what you should try to do. The most important of these tactical and strategic beliefs can be quickly summarized. One was that men on both sides realized that the defense was more powerful than the offense because of recent developments in weapons. And the key development that we would be talking about there is the development of the rifled musket, as opposed to the old smoothbore musket, which had been in use for many decades before the Civil War. The advent of the rifle musket brought great changes to battlefield tactics. Before the Civil War, when both sides were armed with smoothbores, frontal assaults had a much better chance of being successful because the range of the smoothbore weapons, the effective range, was really only about 100 yards. Therefore, it was possible for an attacking force to be on top of the defenders before the defenders could get off many shots against them. It was possible for cavalry to attack infantry because the cavalry could be on top of them very quickly. Possible to bring artillery up close to infantry because if they stayed just 200 or 300 yards out of range of the smoothbore armed infantry, the artillery could fire at the infantry without fear of taking heavy losses.